The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. Sam, a bumper start to the new season over the weekend. And my eyesight's not the best. Was that Kashima in your J-Pred or Shimizu up in the top four?
Unfortunately, on the first day game, it was Kashima. And yeah, fantastic result for Shimizu, probably the result of the weekend. And a weekend that had pretty much everything. We had goals, red cards, controversy, quality play, a lot of rustiness. We went back to the future with some of the players when Okubo, Nakamura, Shinji Ono played, Yuki Abe was there. It had a little bit of everything this weekend.
Most definitely. And, by the way, mate, of course, you're not alone with having Kashima in your J-Pred, and I'm sure they'll bounce back after a disappointing result, at least, in the first match day. Joining us to run through all of the games from the weekend is Dan Orlowitz from the Japan Times. Dan, welcome back to the new season. How are you?
I'm good, Ben. Good to talk to you and Sam. Chaos Energy J-League 2021. Let's do this.
It is well and truly back and banging. There's no question about that. And, mentioned J-Pred right off the top, so I'm sure a lot of our audience has taken part. Of course, Richie Palmer at Gifu Richie's annual J-League Predictions Contest got some pretty mind-boggling statistics from Richie earlier today, Monday, to prep for this episode, guys. So, Richie's run me through the history of J-Pred. It started back in 2016 when 12 people took part, and I don't know if anybody was buying shares in J-Pred all the way back then 5 years ago. Well, then they've made a heck of a lot of money over the years, because this season's edition featured 68 people having a crack at J1 and a 59 for J2, which also got going over the weekend. So, yeah, once again, my maths is not great, but that's more than a 5 times increase in the number of people taking part in J-Pred in just 5 seasons. So, Sam, nobody gets it right, but we certainly love having a crack at it, don't we?
Well, absolutely is, yeah. It's a really great thing that Richie introduced. I don't know if he thought it'd get quite this big, because it looks like he might have to take a week off to sort out the results at the end of the season. But yeah, it's really great, and it's great to see so many people getting involved.
All right, now, Dan, for people who might have missed it on Twitter, because, J-Pred, they were flashing by, especially on Friday afternoon. Do you remember off the top of your head what your top four was and how you're feeling about it after match day one?
I went for, I believe, Kawasaki, Kashima, Gamba, and Hiroshima were my top four. You know, a couple of those were sort of tactical decisions, as I think I tweeted, Hiroshima in particular. Just one of those calls where if I get it right, I'll feel like a genius, and if I get it wrong, it doesn't matter because I get them wrong every year.
Yeah, fair enough. My top four was Kawasaki, Kashima, FC Tokyo, and Yokohama F. Marinos. Obviously, as two of them faced off in match day one, I couldn't have too many winners, but as it turned out, Frontale were the only ones, and do you want to mention yours? I mean, we were plugging it over the past 4 weeks, weren't we? So I guess most of the listeners already know.
Yeah, I had it as Kawasaki, Kashima, FC Tokyo, and Nagoya, so 2 out of 4, I'll take it.
Yep, fair enough then. So, we'll begin our review of match day one by going all the way back to Friday night. The curtain raiser of the season was the defending champions Kawasaki hosting 2019 title winners Yokohama F. Marinos in a Kanagawa derby, a real showpiece occasion to open the season. We were expecting fireworks, Sam, but I guess it's a little bit too simplistic to say it was one-way traffic, but I think it's fairly safe to say that the champions picked up right where they left off.
Yeah, first half especially, it was complete domination from Kawasaki. Yokohama really didn't get going. They, really, really poor, actually. They played this 3-at-the-back formation that we were talking about before, and it caused them a lot of issues, especially down in behind Tiraton, because the way that they're playing, they want these wing-backs to come into midfield when in possession, but Yokohama just couldn't keep possession. So on every turnover, there was so much space in behind Tiraton for Ianaga to kind of infiltrate, and he was superb in throughout the game. Kawasaki played some really nice football. The first goal, I think, is going to take a lot to beat in terms of a quality goal this season. Yeah, really good play, and yeah, Yokohama just didn't get going. Anayu started up front, nothing stuck to him. The midfield was pretty much absent, and yeah, Kawasaki took full advantage.
So, Dan, Scott McIntyre mentioned a couple of weeks ago that Ange Postecoglou's installing a yet another new system at F. Marino's, a new formation, you know, slightly tweaking things as he's want to do on a year-to-year basis. I don't know, could you get the feeling, you were there, of course, for listeners who don't know, at Todoroki on Friday night. Could you get the feeling, could you, I don't know, could you hear Ange and his frustration growing over the course of that first half? Because they did have a half-decent chance in the 17th minute when Jun Amano combined with the rookie Ryunosuke Kabayama, but as the Sam says, apart from that, there really wasn't much happening attacking-wise from an F. Marino's perspective, as they just couldn't keep the ball.
I think it speaks volumes that you could definitely hear Ange during the first half, and not so much during the second, because he had clearly sort of given up a bit on attaining any sort of result, and I don't know. It was watching Marino's, I mean, they're against a team as good as Kawasaki, and you know how that's going to go most of the time. But they just did not seem to have whatever they were trying to do worked out yet. And they were just being picked apart. Both of Ianaga's goals, just class. I mean, for the first in particular, which I tweeted the next morning, you know, SportsCenter needs to put that among their top 10 highlights, because that was easily one of the best goals scored in any game around the world this weekend. And, yeah, you know, Ange said after the game, he talked about how disappointed he was in his players and in the team, and that was pretty evident, because they didn't give him much to look at.
Yeah, he certainly didn't mince his words in his post-match comments on DAZN, did he, Postecoglou? And the ironic thing, Sam, is that, Ianaga scored two fantastic first-half goals, but he's missed the easiest chance he got all night when he volleyed over from 6 yards in between those two goals. So, I mean, you know, we don't want to pile on F. Marinos too much here, and I do want to have a further discussion about them, but, I mean, how bad could the damage really have been? Because the young keeper, Paolo Bina-Obi, had earlier saved well from Kaoru Mitoma before that Amano chance that I'd mentioned. So, I don't know, could it literally have been 4 or 5 nil at halftime?
Oh, quite easily. I think Obi was one of the very few players that got any sort of praise from Postecoglou after the game, and he had to make a lot of good saves. You talked about the Ianaga chance. I mean, it was the easiest one he had all day, and yeah, completely blazed it over. And there were other occasions where there was, just as I was mentioning earlier, with the space that was left in behind, there were so many breaks where Ianaga found himself in a lot of space, and there was a couple of times when the ball just wasn't good enough, but he could have been played in for another chance. There was one where Tanaka was the one who got into that space, and he produced a save out of Obi. So realistically, 5-0 would not have been too much of it wouldn't be too flattering for Kawasaki. They could easily be that. And Yokohama it was probably the formation that they weren't quite used to. Players didn't really know their roles. They kind of changed it up second half and were a lot tighter. But yeah, it was just a horrible day at the office first half for Yokohama.
Indeed. So, all right, well, let's talk the listeners through these two goals then. If you haven't seen the highlights yet, we do recommend getting to the J-League's official YouTube and checking them out if you can. So, yeah, the opener came in the 21st minute. Akihiro Ianaga, ultimately the scorer, combined with Ao Tanaka and Yasuto Wakizaka down the right-hand side. Wakizaka chipped into the box. I'm not sure if he'd actually spotted Miki Yamane's run or not, but Yamane had obviously dashed in from right back, and his superb leaping back heel just screamed, "Volley me in," and Ianaga obliged. As we say, 11 minutes later, it simply had to be 2-0, but Ianaga volleyed over from 6 yards after Kaoru Mitoma had combined with Leandro Damião, who unselfishly squared for Ionaga. But then, yeah, 2 minutes before halftime, Frontale doubled their advantage. Again, the goal was made down the right-hand side. Tanaka, Wakizaka and Leandro combined. This time it was a Tanaka crossing and Ionaga arrived to nod home at the near post. So, yeah, after the break then, we know that Postecoglou is very much, he's got his methods and he sticks to them. So, Dan, was there, a little bit of face-saving that needed to be done by Postecoglou? Because it's not like him to back down from his methods. But as Sam said, he changed the formation at half-time, and that seemed purely to be damage limitation.
I think that when you look at how poorly Marino's played in the first half, you do have to admit that your system isn't working and try to mitigate the damage. And for what it's worth, they did look decent in the second half. Addo and Iwu had that shot hit the left post. I forget exactly what the time on that was, but like that was a good chance on goal, and if that goes in, then it's an entirely different ballgame. But it was clear that Kabayama was overwhelmed up front. He just wasn't quite getting it done. You need to make changes, and if you're going to do them, you might as well do them at halftime when you still got a chance to maybe you sneak in a goal, and then all of a sudden, Kawasaki, as we saw in the Super Cup, can get rattled, and then you've got a chance at a draw.
All right, then. So, Sam, so Scott had bigged up Kabayama, he'd said that he'd heard that there were big raps on him already and that he was a chance to start in match day one, and that was indeed the case. Selected as part of a front three along with Nakagawa and Unaiwu. So he was withdrawn at halftime, related to the formation shift. Also, Tomoki Iwata, one of their off-season signings, of course, from Oita, came in at fullback. So, how did they both fare? And on a broader note, the defending champions away on the opening day of the season is arguably the hardest fixture, you're going to play all season. So, I don't know, as he's trying to bed in this system, was it right to go for it from the start? I mean, we know he's an attack-minded coach, and he's got his way of playing, but did he slightly misjudge, the scale of the task ahead of him here, do you think?
I think it's a tough question. I think that he should go and stick by his methods, because you want to build this team into a team that can go toe-to-toe with Kawasaki and win it. I think maybe when it was so obvious quite early on that it wasn't working, maybe he could have been quicker to change it back, because the fullbacks were getting caught out. Ogihara in central midfield was almost non-existent. You could have put a cone there and it would have done the same job. And they were so overwhelmed, I think maybe he could have changed it quicker. But I don't blame him for necessarily going for it from the start. You want to show to your supporters that you are this Yokohama team, this swashbuckling team, we're going to go for it no matter what. And it just didn't work out in this game. And a lot of it was down to the players as well. No player really played well. And Kabayama was thrown into a team that wasn't playing well, couldn't keep the ball. And he did struggle. I thought he showed some promising signs. When he got the ball, he would try and go at defenders. But often he might have beaten Yamane in the first instance, but then he just ran into Jessiel. And, Jessiel kind of dominated him for most of the game. And it was a tough one for Iwata as well. He didn't really get the chance to show his attacking qualities that he did at Oita. I don't think the system really fits him when you have the wing-back, as it was Wada, I think it was, at the start of this game. He tucks in. It kind of limits the space for Iwata to go forward. So it didn't really help him. Plus, that back line was so exposed by the lack of control they had in midfield. It was just he spent a lot of his time running back towards his own goal. So, really tough opening games for both of them. But I don't think you should necessarily rule either of them out based on this one performance.
Okay, so usually after match day one, we roll out to Overreaction Theatre, again with a nod to the ESPN Fantasy Focus podcast. But I don't think we're ruling F. Marino's out of anything after one match day. But I guess a sobering result and a disappointing performance that, as we've said, Postecoglou didn't mince his words in his post-match interview with DAZN. So, Dan, there was a question from Khalil on our new Patreon exclusive line group related to Ange and how critical he was of the playing group. Khalil says, with the exception of Orbi and Kabayama, Khalil wonders how we think Ange's criticism might go down with the Japanese players, especially as this is not a usual habit from Ange's coaching career. Obviously, Australian coaches, well, back home, you'd be putting a rocket up your players' backsides to sharpen them up for the next week. But I guess on a case by case basis, some players might not react too well to the coach going off on them. So I don't know. How do you think will we see a proper reaction from F. Marinos in their next league game, or do you think there might be a few of them go back into their shells?
I think that when a coach like Ange, who's usually very much behind his players and supports them even when the results don't go their way, when he tells you that you done goofed, you really know it. And I was actually the one in the press conference who asked him about Obi and what he thought about his performance, and he was very positive. He said that Obi was one of the two or three players who had a good game. I was asking in the context of him being a young goalkeeper who's been thrust into this J1 starting role rather suddenly. But I think that he has shown with Obi and with Kabayama that you do need a softer touch with young players, especially. You can't go breathing down their necks. And he did point out when he talked about Kabayama that the rest of the squad let him down. And I think that if you're a veteran, that's something that you have to take seriously. To be told by your coach that, like, listen, these young players are doing their best, but you've got to step up. You're the veterans. You're the ones who are supposed to lead the squad forward. I think that that's a message that the players should get. And if they aren't getting it, then that's another problem entirely.
Yeah, fair enough. And thanks for your question, Khalil. Before we move off this game, Sam, obviously Frontale have completely dominated the first half. And then, as Dan said, they were slightly off the pace in the second, echoes of the Super Cup the previous week, and I guess some of their performances towards the end of last season. So, I don't know, will Toru Aniki be putting a rocket up his players' backsides this week in training? And, as Dan said as well, with Onaiwu hitting the post just after the hour, if that had gone in, then obviously it's a completely different game. It looks, in the cut and dried light of day, that this was a dominating win, and we can't argue with the quality of goals in the first half. But that's obviously Gumba got themselves back into the Super Cup last week, and if Marino's had chances to do so again here. So I guess Oniki might be a little bit worried about this becoming a trend.
Yeah, I think it's something he does have to address. As you say, it's been going on for a little while now, and they didn't get into the game as Gamba did last week, but they could easily have. Kawasaki just started that second half very sloppily. The Onayu chance comes from just a lot of overplaying at the back, and they get, I think it was Tanaka who got caught, and Onayu went in on goal and had his effort on goal. And it wasn't just the defending that was a little bit sloppy. They still had chances going the other way, but maybe overplayed it there as well, that some of the passing wasn't quite on. So yeah, I think there are things to work on. You can't just be 2-0 up and think you're cruising at half time and then just not really show up second half, because eventually one team is going to come back and bite them. So yeah, it is something that Aniki, I'm sure he will address, and I'm sure it is something that Kawasaki will improve upon. But yeah, I think it is a little bit worrying at the moment in kind of how often it has happened in at the start of this season and at the back end of last season.
All right. Well, for now, they're rolling along pretty nicely indeed. The defending champions, the Super Cup winners last week, and then, getting off to a winning start in a derby, no less, to kick off the season last Friday night. All right. Well, Sam, we've talked about it right off the top. So arguably the biggest shock of match day one came at the Kashima Soccer Stadium, where Antlers hosted Shimizu S-Pulse. Everything was going fairly well for Antlers right up until the time when they took the lead with 15 minutes left when Ryotaro Araki volleyed in after they had hit the woodwork for, I believe it was the third time. Sean Madoy two times previously, and Everaldo, his header from a corner came back off the bar and allowed Araki, who was unmarked, to volley home from inside the six-yard box. But from there, to say S-Pulse turned this game on its head is a massive understatement. The visitors running out 3-1 winners.
Yeah, it was incredible, really, the kind of turnaround in the game, because, as you said, for 75 minutes, Kashima pretty much bossed it. Shimizu had maybe one or two counter-attacks, but really it was all Kashima. I think the final shot count was something like 20-7 in Kashima's favour. But, yeah, the impact that, well, the response from Shimizu when they went a goal down was fantastic. They scored almost straight away from kick-off. They were really positive. They got men forward, which you don't always associate with a Latino side, and they just really went for it. They got that first goal. It gave them so much confidence, and they just carried on, and it was only one winner from there. And they took their goals very well. The second goal, the header from Goto, I thought was sublime. And yeah, full credit to them. They kept Kashima, it kept it as tight as possible. They defended very well, even though they rode their luck a little bit, as you mentioned, with the efforts going off the crossbar. But yeah, I thought they defended very well in the main, and then they took their chances superbly at the end.
Yeah, I couldn't believe my eyes when I checked the scores and saw that, firstly that Shimizu had won, but then in the manner that they had, Dan, and Sam's right. Yeah, the fight back, the belief to just keep going. And, Thiago Santana got them back level just, 2.5 minutes after they had fallen behind. And then 5 minutes later, little Yusuke Goto arrived to power home a header. It didn't look like he could believe it either before the unfortunate ISA Weider, the ball basically went in off him for an own goal with 2 minutes left. And Sam, 20-7. I also saw 25-8 as a shot count elsewhere. 20-7 was the official J-League one, but elsewhere I saw 25-8. So whichever way you slice it, Dan, for 75 minutes this was a dominant Antlers performance, but you never can tell in the J-League, can you?
You can't. I think that a lot of people are looking at Kashima as title contenders, especially given that they won't have the ACL on their plates like Kawasaki do this season. But I don't know. I think that Latinia has a decent squad. He's got some interesting ideas, and I think that Latinia is a manager with something to prove. Because he did get shafted by Cereso, and I think that he's going to want revenge, and there's no sweeter revenge than finishing above your former team on the table. So I think that they're going to be interesting to watch this season. I don't know if they can keep it going, but if they can start playing like that in the first half, then S-Pulse are going to be something to watch.
Yeah, pretty stunning result. As we all know, S-Pulse struggled mightily last season. For Antlers, a strange trend has continued. They have not won on the opening day since 2016. Four wins and a draw, and they've lost the last three opening day fixtures. Once, of course, famously to Oita on their return to the top flight a couple of years ago. So, full credit to S-Pulse, as we've tried to say. Yeah, the fact that they were able to come from behind after being dominated for well over an hour is a massive feather in their cap. And Sam, were there other, apart from the fight back and, as you say, throwing the kitchen sink at it, was their performance otherwise in the lead up to the goal, as it stayed 0-0, was it all hallmarks of the Latina Cerezo, or were there different tweaks that you could ascertain as they tried to bed in so many new players? I believe it was seven new players to the club in the starting 11 on for match day one.
Yeah, it was a very similar to the way he'd set up at Suarez. And I think Alan Gibson had a question on our line group, which was kind of along these lines. In what sort of formation did they set up? Were they a bit more attacking? And I'd say really no. They played the 4-2-3-1 that you'd associate really with Cerezo, and with Di Sarro playing off Santana and Carlinhos one side, Nakayama the other. So very similar. For large parts of this game, it was 10 men behind the ball, limit the space that Kashima had to work in, kind of force them wide and deal with the crosses, and generally speaking they did that. It's tough when you play against a player like Everaldo, who is so good in the air, but then you've got a goalkeeper in Gonda who made a fantastic save from an Everaldo header in the I think it was the 30th minute, something like that, and then they managed to get the block on from, I think it was Doyer's follow-up, which was then deflected onto the post. So I think even though they conceded chances like that, the defending itself was very good. The goalkeeping was good. I think Suzuki, again, the centre-back they brought in from Oita, he was so important to the way Oita played at the back. He kind of was the one that was in charge of everyone. He got everyone in their right position at Oita. And he did that again here because, Hara's a very good defender. So was Katayama. And Valdo was part of the team last year, which was a bit of a mess. But he was kind of led a bit, I think, by Suzuki. And he was a lot more disciplined in his defending. And I thought that was kind of the hallmark of most of this game. And it allowed them to stay in the game, even though it went 1-0. And then they had that switch that you didn't always see at Cerezo, where they went forward in numbers from the 75th minute onwards. So that was maybe the one tweak I saw, but generally speaking, it was very much a Cerezo-type performance.
All right, then. Yeah, Alan Gibson always won with a penetrating question or two, and he did not let us down on this occasion. Thank you for getting involved, Alan, and yeah, I know he does have a soft spot for Espoz going back to the Ashin Gopi days. So, a very good result for anybody of an orange from Shizuoka perspective at the Kashima Soccer Stadium on Saturday afternoon. All right, so, from Kashima, we'll head further north, gents, all the way up to the Sapporo Dome for the biggest result of match day one. Host Sapporo made to say it was a dream start is the understatement of the season so far. Two goals in the first 4 minutes from their first two shots, both deflected to wrong foot. Yokohama FC goalkeeper Yuji Rokutan sent Consadole on their way to a 5-1 opening day triumph over their visitors from Kanagawa. Both goals from basically identical spots on the pitch, Sam, from just inside the 18-yard box on Rokutan's left, on the right as we watch it on TV. Komai's deflected. It squirmed under Yutaro Hakamata, didn't it? And then, 2 minutes later, Takuro Kaneko's deflected off Shunsuke Nakamura's leg. A bigger question is, what on earth is Shunsuke Nakamura doing starting in central midfield in a J1 midfield in 2021?
Well, it's the question I was asking. I mean, you go to Sapporo and everyone knows how a Misha Petrovic team is going to set up. You've got the two holding midfielders, you've got the two attacking midfielders. So they're very strong in that area. And for Yokohama to go there with a two-man midfield, one was a kind of a rookie and in Yasunaga, and the other was a 42-year-old Shunsuke Nakamura, who I love Shunsuke Nakamura, but he can't run. He cannot cover the ground that's needed against that sort of Shimizu team. So it was just terrible team selection, and they struggled from the off. They were cut open time and time again, and they got so much space. Sapporo. I felt for Rokutan, who made a lot of good saves and was done in by quite a few deflections in this game. But it was part of the defence just didn't get out to anyone. They were kind of half and half, which left them kind of in no man's land and there to deflect the shots in. So, yeah, I thought Yokohama, the team selection was atrocious. And I think the performance, again, was pretty poor. But you're going to have to give credit to Sapporo as well. They took full advantage of this. Ogashiwa is the standout for me in terms he played just off the striker in one of those two with Chanatip. I thought he got on the ball really well. He was positive. He got three assists in the game. It was just, absolutely fantastic, because previously he played up front and his kind of finishing let him down occasionally. But I really like this more withdrawn role, and he worked really well there. So credit to Sapporo, but Yokohama were dreadful.
Yeah, I don't know, Dan. I mean, he can kick it in the window of a moving bus, can't he, Shunsuke? But, yeah, he can't really get himself around the pitch anymore. So that was, a head-scratching move, to say the least, by the Yokohama FC coach. And, again, overreaction theatre time. I feel pretty good about having Yokohama FC in my bottom four as things stand. Although, of course, we don't wish relegation on anybody, supporters of any team. But, we'll wait and see, obviously. They've got to bounce back from that result and betting in some new players, obviously. Don't worry, we will get back to talking about Sapporo, and indeed Charlotte's got a question from our line group. But Dan, so one of their new signings, one of their about 7,000 new strikers, Kleber, who's come in from Chiba, he got them back to 2-1 down just before the half hour. So although they'd been completely dominated to that point, when the rookie Yuya Takagi surged into the box on the left and squared for Kleber, he couldn't miss. It was game on, I suppose. But, Sapporo very, very quickly shut the door just before half time.
It was a very Sapporo-like goal to give up, leaving so much space behind them for Kleber to slip into. It's... That goal wasn't something that Sapporo should have necessarily given up. I mean, credit to Yokohama. That was a good sequence and a good finish. I've got the highlights going on silently as we talk. And man, Yokohama just weren't good. I think that it's a long road. Let's remember again. Speaking of overreaction theater, 38 round season. This is a long one, so it is hard to take one result and declare that the end is nigh, but they're going to have to play much. They need to start looking like they did in the first half of last season if they're going to have any sort of chance to get out of this.
Indeed. Well, they've got Yusuke Matsuo back as well, so he came off the bench in the second half, so that's great to see him back approaching full fitness. They'll definitely need him to be at the peak of his powers, I think, if they're going to do much going forward, despite their collection of new strikers. But Sam, they closed the door right on half time, didn't they? It appeared it was game on, but then Anderson Lopez chested in a very unselfish square ball from the previously mentioned Tsuyoshi Ogashiwa. And then in the fourth minute of first half stoppage time, Kaneko scored again from a similar spot to his first one, but there was no deflection on this. A superb strike after Rokutan had saved from Anderson Lopez. So, why don't you have a crack at Charlotte's question then? You've mentioned Ogashiwa yourself, and Charlotte was wondering whether he deserves a chance at starting more.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was one of these specially designated players last season, so there was kind of a month in the season that he was brought in, and he played up front kind of on his own a little bit because Charlotte wasn't really there to support him, and yeah, he kind of struggled in that role, but he's played throughout pre-season. He's playing in this more withdrawn role in behind Anderson Lopez, and I thought he worked so well. Him and Chanatip, the combinations, especially for this third goal for Anderson Lopez, where it's just, it played into Chanatip, he flicks it over beautifully, then it's cushioned across by Ogashiwa into Anderson Lopez. It's a terrific goal, and it's a really positive sign if that link-up can work and can be used more often, because you see when Bothroyd plays up there, and I don't have anything against Bothroyd, he's just a different type of player, and that link-up is not always there in the way that it can be with Anderson Lopez and with Ogashiwa and Chanatip, as they showed in this game. So, yeah, it was really positive, and I think he'll definitely get himself a start next weekend, and, yeah, hopefully many, many more games to come, because they've got a lot of good youngsters coming through at Sapporo. They bedded in Takamine and Tanaka last season. I think he'll do the same with Ogashiwa this year.
And just to wrap up Charlotte's post, a few points questions in there. So, Sam, Dan's mentioned an extremely small sample size, but again, it's the only one game we've got to go on. Was this performance a flash in the pan against a poor side, or is this potentially the start of something? I mean, we know how inconsistent they were last year, but they're not going to come up against a defence as welcoming, I suppose, as Yokohama FC every week.
Yeah, it's a difficult question based off this one game, because I don't think they'll face an easier opponent all year the way Yokohama played this game. But Consadole usually are a streaky team. They're quite a confidence-based team, so when they get on a run, they can look fairly unstoppable at times, but then a couple of results go against them and it turns into a long stretch of poor performances. So, yeah, hopefully for them, it was definitely positive signs for them going forward, but they were helped out so much by Yokohama. I think you're going to have to wait until next weekend to see what sort of result that is, because it's going to be a much sterner test when they face Nagoya away from home.
Rightio. Now, Sam, we're three games in. Correct me if I'm wrong, but there weren't any major VAR incidents in any of these three games, were there?
No, thank goodness for the length of this podcast, because we're going to get into them later.
Yeah, I was going to say, because things are about to get a little bit fruity slash a little bit murky as we turn our attention to the, well, not the first, but one of the major talking points from the weekend at the Yanmar Stadium, where Cerezo Osaka have ultimately defeated 10-man Kashiwa Reysol 2-0. And, the major controversy, I guess, centres around the straight red card shown to Takumi Kamijima in the 35th minute after, Academy Award winning, Olympic gold medal winning performance by Yoshito Okubo to hit the deck about three or four steps after he had been touched on the shoulder by Kamijima. I guess if the referee believes it to be sufficient contact, then he's well within his rights to punish Kamijima, as he's the last man. But to say that Okubo made the most of it, Dan, is quite an understatement, isn't it?
I think that I will be very generous and say that Okubo is a veteran. Who knows exactly how to move in certain situations. And, we go back and forth on this as fans of Japanese football, because it's always that question of, national team players need to be smarter about, staying up at all costs, and they should be willing to fall if it means getting a favorable free kick or even a penalty. And then Okubo does something like this, and all of a sudden we're up in arms about it. I'm not going to say that it wasn't a bit of a diving. Let's just get the word out there. But, he's been in this game old enough, or long enough, I should say, and he's old enough to know exactly how things are going to go, and that's just part of the game. VAR should pick this up. It didn't this time, and hopefully we get some feedback from the usual gang on Judge Replay this week, and they'll review it.
Sam, so I guess, the clear and obvious error terminology comes into play here, and the VAR, I suppose, is obviously checking this this decision from as many angles as he can, and he has come to the conclusion that there wasn't enough evidence to overrule the referee on the field's decision. What did you make of it at the time, and ultimately was it the correct decision?
Like, I think just looking at it live, and if you look at it from where the referee was, I can understand why the referee is given a red card, and this is where you need the technology and the video assistant referee to come in and help him out, because if there is any contact, it's minimal at best. There's no way Okubo should be going down. And in my view, I think it should be overturned. Maybe the video referee has thought, okay, there's a potential that there is contact, so maybe it's not a complete error from the referee and he's just sided with him in that way. But yeah, for me, I don't think this is a red card. I think Kamijima has been very harshly treated. And it was the second incident of VAR in this game, which I think was dealt with pretty badly.
Okay, do tell. What's the other one?
Yeah, well, the other one was a few minutes earlier where Cerezo thought they'd scored. The ball was headed on from a corner. Marahashi then punches the ball onto the crossbar and Ayumu Seko goes on and scores. And for whatever reason, it's not seen by the on-field referees, which is baffling to me. If this last season, that would have counted. And then it takes 2 minutes and 45 seconds from the ball going into the net before they actually make a decision to disallow the goal. And you won't get a clearer decision. And granted, they've got to the right result in the end, but why it takes so long when it takes one look at that to see he's punched it, it should take no more than 30 seconds. And that is my biggest bugbear with VAR, is that it takes so long. Everyone's just sat around for far too long waiting for a decision. And when it's so clear-cut as this, I mean, there's no excuse for it to take as long as it did.
Yes, you're right, mate. And I forgot the chronology of it. So yeah, I was going to talk about the punch. You're right. And the fact that the referee had to go over to look at the monitor as well. I mean, the VAR should just be able to tell him, no, mate, he's punched it against the bar. You can't allow the goal. It's a race hole free kick. Again, it's just wasting more time, isn't it? Just having him run over to check the one of the most obvious decisions of all time. So, that's a good point. And sorry, Dan, I should have mentioned before I asked Sam the question before. I mean, your point is an excellent one about Okubo's experience and, the fact that we often decry Japanese players for their lack of, in inverted commas, militia. When the shoe's on the other foot and, we sook about it, well, we should realise that, we oftentimes wish that, Japanese players were a bit more street smart. I don't know, it just happened to be Okubo, I suppose, and it just happened to be, from a race hall perspective, obviously it had to be Okubo who opened the scoring 7 minutes after Kamijima's straight red. It's a good header. There's no question. To me, it looked slightly offside, but obviously the VAR has checked that as well and decided it wasn't. There's plenty of life in the old dog yet, I suppose. Not quite along the same lines of Shunsuke Nakamura, but I think a lot of us were very surprised to see Okubo in the starting lineup. But for one reason or another, or a couple of very decent reasons, he certainly made his stamp on this game.
Yeah, there's talk about whether or not we're going to see him get to 200 J1 goals this season, which is totally plausible if he stays healthy and if he keeps poaching. I do think that a lot of the outrage over this dive is that it's Yoshida Okubo. He's not exactly, I wouldn't say he's not a fan favorite, but he is certainly a player that some segments of the fandom love to hate. So I think that if he was a no-name defender, if it was, a journeyman or whoever, I don't think we'd be making as big a deal over this. But I just do think that the fact that it is Okubo adds some spectacle to the affair.
Yeah, just something I forgot to mention earlier. Cesare posted this into our Patreon line group. For the ball that went over the top that Okubo goes through, he's actually offside when the ball's played before Kamijima brings him down. So that wasn't reviewed by the VAR. So that is another part of this which Kashua will feel very harshly treated by. And whatever way you look at it, that should not have been a red card.
Yeah, we've got some more of our controversy to talk about shortly. But so, Dan, some of the listeners will not know that the scope of VAR in J1 is not as wide as it is in other leagues. So, if you could give us just a brief your brief cliff notes on what exactly VAR is able and not able to check in J1.
In the J1, it is able to check four items, events, and those are goals, penalties, red cards, and then player identification. For example, if there's a scrum involving multiple players and they want to make sure that they're carding the right person, because we have gotten occasional incidents of mistaken identity over the seasons. So it isn't going to call off an offside, for the sake of it. If there was an offside play in the build-up to a goal during the review, they would see it and they would call it off. But it is also supposed to be in case of a clear mistake. If it is very apparent from looking at the video review that the wrong call was made, then VAR is there to overturn it. So the question is sort of what is a clear mistake and what isn't. But it isn't going to be a situation where they're looking very tightly at these sort of edge cases and you know, seeing if a player is has a toe above the line and that sort of thing. We're not at that point. And it is also worth noting that the J League broadcasts don't have the number of cameras that they do in the Premier League, for example. So we aren't going to get the 3D wall and like those sorts of simulations.
I see. Okay, then. All right. So, we obviously got another Cerezo goal to talk about. But, Sam, before we move on to that, I'm interested in your thoughts on Kashiwa Reysol and their performance in this game. Obviously, for the first half hour or so, when the teams were at 11 versus 11, how they looked. Obviously, trying to fill that Michael Olunga-shaped hole up front. And then how they battled on for almost half the game. Down to 10 men, Okubo scoring the opener with 3 minutes to go in the first half, and then Tatsuhiro Sakamoto killing them off, I suppose you could say, with 5 minutes left, finishing off after a bit of a ruckus in the box, a few Cerezo chances in quick succession. So your thoughts on Reysol, and also to ask you with four or five questions at once, Steve Fryer from our patrons line group asked about Ipe Shinazuka, whether you think he'll get chances at Reysol to impress, as Steve obviously likes to keep his eye on ex-Omiya players when they move to other clubs.
Yeah, well, the start of the game, I thought the first 20 minutes or so, it was all Kashiwa. They were pretty much camped in the Cerezo half. Goya, who is the man who's playing up front to kind of fill this void left by Olunga, he had two kind of half-ish chances, but didn't really connect with any of them. And then Cristiano had a chance where the Cerezo defence was just caught completely square and flat-footed over the top. Cristiano got in, but his shot was straight at Kim, so they dominated that stage. Cerezo did then get into it. I thought Sakamoto was probably their best player on the day, and he kind of injected a bit of life into them, and that kind of led to the series of chances where they scored the goal that didn't count, and then the red cards and all of that. And then the kind of the rest of the first half kind of fizzled out after the first goal, and then second half really it was really tight. You wouldn't necessarily know that Kashiwa had the 10 men compared to Cerezo. Cerezo didn't create too many chances, really, before the chances you mentioned, where it was a series of shots towards the end of the game. It was very tight. Like, Kashiwa, as attacking as they look at as a team, they are used to sitting back, sitting deep. If you remember the Levain Cup semi-finals last year, where that's all they did against Yokohama, they just sat deep, and they are good at that. And they kind of kept Cerezo at arm's length. They didn't really have many chances themselves, so they missed that out ball that Olunga gives them, because they could just launch it up to Olunga and he would either then take it on himself and score a goal, or he would hold the ball up and allow the likes of Isaka and Sagawa to get up with him. So they really did miss that. So, I mean, it looks at the moment, until they get their new players in from Brazil, I think they are going to struggle to score many goals, but it's hard to take too much from this game when they've played so much of it down to 10 men. And onto Steve's question on Shinozuka, I think almost identical the time last year, we got a question, how much is Goya going to get a chance at Kashiwa? And then he was unfortunately behind Olunga, who had one of the best seasons we've seen of a striker in the J-League. So that was difficult for him. Shinozuka plays, really his position is probably where Cristiano's going to play. And I think in the main, I think he's going to be limited more to Levain Cup ties and maybe the odd substitute appearance. I think that three behind the striker is pretty much set, and I'd almost argue that Nakama could be ahead of him as well. But he's got these. That's the beauty of the Levain Cup. If there is a beauty, it gives players like Shinozuka a real chance to impress. So maybe in midweek he has a fantastic game, plays himself into contention. But at the start, I think he'd be more a bench player to start with.
All right, fair enough. So, yeah, thanks for your question, Steve. Steve also wondered whether there has been a better bit of a transfer business in the last 4 years than Ian Aga from Omiya to Kawasaki, and certainly one does not come straight to my mind, Steve. Yeah, I mean, other than, I suppose, you know, a team like Kashiwa getting Ilunga into the country. But, yeah, but I mean, between from club to club in the J-League, yeah, I can't think of anything that compares. And, yeah, Iyanaga obviously has three league winners' medals and a Player of the Season award to show for it. So, yep. Yeah, I'm interested actually to see how Shinazuka gets on, as he's bounced around a little bit. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see, as Sam says, if he can grab his chances in the Levain Cup. Speaking of, we obviously do have a lot more games to cover, but James Clark had a question about the Levain Cup. It's obviously the first match day of it is coming up this midweek. James wonders, how seriously do we expect teams to take the League Cup matches this week? Have any said anything the level of rotation they'll undertake, if any? So, Dan, in a typical season, yeah, how seriously do teams take the Levain Cup, and are you expecting anything different this season? Are you surprised, firstly, that they kept the full extended group stage, or I would have preferred to a much more streamlined version like they had they were forced into last year?
I think we sort of would all prefer that. Yeah, teams are very coy about how they approach the Levain Cup, and you know, if you ask any club, they'll say that they're in it to win it. No manager worth his paycheck is going to come out and say that no, we're just going to use it to train the young players, and it doesn't really matter how we do in the group stages. We're focused on avoiding relegation or qualifying for the ACL or whatever. And it has become this sort of weird in between tournament, and until 2019. It was also a chance for clubs to actually, they were required to include a number of homegrown players in their squads. And I believe there, if memory serves, there was an under something rule. It could have been under 23 or under 22, but they did have to put in some young players. And those rules are not in place for this season because of COVID and all the restrictions that can potentially be placed on rosters if something goes wrong. So yeah, it's a mixed bag. I think every club wants to win the Levain Cup. Not every club wants to go through the bullshit to get there.
Yeah, unfortunately for Sam, he has to sit through each and every minute of it. But yeah, I don't know, Sam. In some ways, do you? Oh yeah, it's the wrong phrasing. But do you appreciate it? Because you do get exposed to all of the young players. So you could say that you've seen them first.
Yeah, to an extent. That's the one positive, I suppose. It is good to see some of these young players that come through. I think Kubo's first game, I think, was the Levain Cup, and one of the, I think it might have been Golden Week, and he came on and he kind of, I was sat in the office, I'd talked to Kubo up for ages, and then he came up for a free kick that I think was saved. But yeah, so you do get to see these sorts of moments, and you see young players that come through. If you look back to the Levain Cup last year, I think that's where Mitoma really came through to start with. We're in a couple of performances in that competition. So yeah, you do see these young players. It is good to get to see a lot of them. You also, they're high breeding grounds for King Kazu. You've got to expect he might appear in the Levain Cup group game. You might see Shinji Ono play a lot more. So, yeah, you get to see veterans. You get to see young players coming through. It's a little bit of annoying, especially when you play a double round robin that goes on forever. But, yeah, there are some positives to it.
Yeah, all right. Well, thanks for your question, James. On a week-to-week basis, we don't spend an enormous amount of time on the Levain Cup group stage. You probably notice, if you look at the timer on your podcast player, we've been going for about 50 minutes and we've talked about four games. So we don't really have much extra time to chat about the Levain Cup in much detail. But yeah, we will keep an eye on, maybe if Kazu gets a run out, we might mention it next week. All right, well, yeah, so a bit of our controversy in the Cerezo Kashiwa game. We've got more to come after a quick hit of music, so stay with us, listeners. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I mentioned there was some more VAR controversy And yes, indeed, we'll head down to Shonan for that, where host Belmare entertained Sagan Tosu, of course, at the newly rebranded Lemon Gas Stadium, where things turned sour for the hosts with 10 minutes left when Daichi Hayashi broke the deadlock from the penalty spot after a very lengthy delay, Sam. Confusion reigned on the terraces, people watching at home as well. Finally, I think we can agree that the correct decision was made by the referee after consulting with VAR, but it took an awful long time to get there, didn't it?
Yeah, it took over 6 minutes from the foul first committed to the penalty actually being scored. I mean, that's far too long. There were various circumstances involved in this. There was an injury to Tani as well in the build-up to the during the decision. But yeah, it went on too long. I'll try and be as succinct as possible. Lino gets in down the right-hand side. He cuts in, he's fouled by Takahashi, which is where the penalty is eventually given, but it's not given straight away. The ball carries up, the game carries on. Tosu have two shots that are both saved. There is a collision where, and I believe that the referee gives a free kick to Shonan the other way. I mean, the judge replay on Friday or Tuesday or whenever you get to see that will clear that up, but that's what I believe. So that free kick is given. They're attending to Tani. There are two occasions in the middle of this where the referee signals that a replay is a review is being conducted. It just goes on forever and ever. He signals again at 75:46, which is like 2.5 minutes after the initial foul. Then finally, almost 4 minutes after the original foul, he signals that he's going to go to the monitor. He then looks at that for another minute and then finally awards a penalty, and then they eventually score it. So it just takes far too long. The decision is correct, but yeah, there is no reason for it to take 6 odd minutes.
Yeah, it was really confusing. And Dan, I've got to admit, yeah, having only seen the highlights from this game, I wasn't fully aware of the timeline about what had happened in the order, and obviously the fact that the Tani was down, the Shonan goalkeeper was down receiving treatment, I wasn't aware of that as well, because obviously they didn't linger on that in the brief highlights package. But both you and Sam have sat through the entire 6 odd minutes of game time, where obviously nothing happens apart from Eno getting fouled and then the referee stopping play. So I think that confusion, it was confusing, the fact that ultimately the referee hadn't given the penalty, but the VAR did, as Sam says, the correct decision was made. But I guess it's just one of those teething problems of the system.
It's remember, VAR was supposed to start last season. They called it off because of COVID, and because basically not just the number of games happening in a short period of time and the number of referees available, but also they wanted to make sure that the video referees were safe, because it's an enclosed space and they have to talk a lot. I think you're going to have these sort of growing pains. It was, watching the sequence today, we discussed it before recording, very Zapruder film-esque vibe to it all. I think that J-League Vice Chairman Hiro Mihara, who runs the Judge Replay show, he's going to have to go frame by frame and figure out what happened. I'm sure that the mechanisms for review are going to have a field day with it. I think it's going to be, it could become sort of a textbook case going forward, just so that the people in charge of refereeing and assessment understand what happened and how potentially to fix it. But it is a very chaotic sequence, and it is easy to understand why it took them so long to figure it out. But of course, it, as Sam says, it shouldn't have taken them 5 minutes.
All right, and Sam, so we got a question from Johnny Nickel, and I don't want to put words in Johnny's mouth after the event, but I reckon Johnny might have been going on the same highlights package that I was, because after Takahashi commits the foul on Ino, as Johnny says in his question, Tosu have, and you've mentioned as well, Sam, Tosu have two shots on target between the original foul and the game being stopped to check VAR. So when the referee blows his whistle initially, it does look like he's pointing to the spot to award penalties pointing in the direction of the Shawnun goal, which leads you to believe he's awarding a penalty. And obviously we've seen the foul take place, and we know it is later given as a penalty. But the fact that Tosu had two shots, the ball, as you say, the game was allowed to continue, means the referee was not giving a penalty for that, because if it was a penalty, he would have given the penalty in the initial passage of play where Takahashi committed the foul. So, as you said, you believe that the referee was actually going to go award a free kick to Shawnun in the ruckus that ensued after that. And, as you say, in that six-minute time period, he was making all kind of gestures. So Johnny's question was, where do you guys feel the cutoff point should be when an attacking team's advantage is over? In this case, I understand the question, Johnny, but I don't think it actually relates to the situation, does it, Sam? Because if the referee sees a foul in the box, he's supposed to award a penalty on the spot. He doesn't then pay an advantage where he would, say, if something happened in the middle of the park.
Yeah, generally speaking, if he believes there's a foul for a penalty, he will just give a penalty. Especially in this instance, the ball is just crossing over. It's not like there's a clear opportunity. Say, for example, if two players are going through, one is taken out by the goalkeeper, but then he can play advantage because the other striker is there to tap it in. That's the only incident where I'd say that they'd play an advantage. I don't think he would ever have seen that foul, thought that could be a penalty, but I'll just give them two chances to score before going back. I just don't think that's the way it's happened. There was after the various shots, I think Hayashi collides with Tanaka in the box. I think that's where he gives the free kick to Shonan. So I think that's the way he was looking at it, rather than awarding an advantage.
All right, so elsewhere, I mean, the highlights were fairly strongly in Shonan's favour. In the fourth minute, Yuki Ohashi's shot came back off the bar after he cut in from the left. Shonan had the ball in the net themselves 6 minutes before half-time when their captain Takuya Okamoto scored, but the ball had deflected off Naoki Yamada's arm after his initial shot was saved by Park Il-gyu. Then after Tosu went ahead with 5 minutes left, the Shonan substitute Ryo Nemoto shot wide when one-on-one with Park. So Belmare, they can't say they didn't have their opportunities, and indeed were unfortunate with the disallowed goal, the ball brushing Yamada's arm, but the referee called that on the spot, and he said to the Tosu keeper Park that he'd seen it and he'd done a good job, so he was pretty happy with himself. So Tosu get off to a winning start. Two teams a lot of us expect to struggle in 2021, so any away win for Sagan this year will be well and truly welcome. No questions asked. All right, so to the late game then on Saturday at the Noivir Stadium. That also ended 1-0, but this time to the hosts. Vissel Kobe faced off against Gunma Osaka in a Kansai derby. It was goalless until the 79th minute, and then that man, Kyogo Furuhashi, won it for the hosts, Sam.
Kind of a bitty game. I didn't think either team were quite playing as well as they could do, but there was some quality, and that was the goal. The ball through from Yamaguchi is absolutely sublime. Furuhashi gets in behind Shoji. Higashiguchi's caught a little bit between two places, and the chip is fantastic, and it was a really good goal. It was just typical of Furuhashi, and worthy of winning any game. But as I say, I think it was a little bit of a bitty game. Gamba probably had the best chances, but in terms of general play, I think Kobe kept the ball better. So it could have gone either way, but that goal was worthy of winning any game.
Yeah, most definitely. All right, so Dan, we're certainly not going to get carried away here in the overreaction theatre about one Kobe win. They've burned us too many times in the last two or three years. But what about from a Gumba perspective? This is it's only one game, but it's a derby. It's a game you want to win. You want to get off to a good start. And the fact that they weren't really able to express themselves with more of a full-strength team than they were able to put out in the Super Cup the previous week will leave their supporters a little bit frustrated, I would suggest.
I'd agree with that assessment. They didn't... I thought that Gamba played okay. I thought they had their chances, I think, until Furuhashi scores that just
I mean, what a goal that! I was nearly out of my chair watching that, and I think that Gamba had their chances, and they probably deserve to walk away with points on aggregate. Tsuneyasu Miyamoto is dealing with somewhat of a new squad, not a new squad, but you know he is still growing. This squad. This squad is still percolating. It is not nearly at, you know, Kawasaki-esque levels of, you know, running at 100%. And there's going to be a bit of a slow start. But, you know, if I'm a Gamba fan, I'm not panicking yet. I don't think that what we saw on Saturday is anywhere near that level.
All right, so before we move on, Sam, Kobe obviously without the injured Andres Iniesta, but they're able to welcome in Shion Inoue, a signing that got a little bit of buzz in the off season. What did you make of his debut in Vissel Crimson?
Decent. I wouldn't say he set the world alight, but he was quite active. He was the one who had a shot first half that Higashiguchi saved low to his left. But generally, he was decent. I mean, they're all good passes that you have to be in that Kobe team, and he was that. I don't think he put many passes astray. I don't necessarily think... I think there's more to come from him and more from everyone, really, in terms of going forward and... there wasn't many times where he got the ball and slipped in a key pass, a bit like the Yamaguchi one. There wasn't anything like that, but neat and tidy. And for a young player making their J1 debut, I think he did very well.
And anything from a Gamba perspective, personnel-wise or formation-wise, that took you by surprise?
Not particularly. They carried on with their 4-3-3 formation, which it's a slight change in system, but in terms of the way that they play, it doesn't change too much. They didn't play... Kurata was maybe the one surprise where Kawasaki got the nod again at left wing. I didn't see too much from him, and in fact he almost caused Kobe to score where he was back defending and he misplaced a pass for Shoji and it allowed Furuhashi and he ran in on goal and just didn't shoot. He squared it for some reason, I'm not sure why, so that could easily have been 2-0 at the time, or that might have been the first goal, I can't remember. But yeah, they didn't really look... Usami came back, but I'm not sure he was completely fit. He didn't quite look on it, and he then went off. I think he was struggling again. So yeah, there are a few issues there. They've still got the Brazilians in Leandro Pereira and Thiago Alves, who are not quite up to speed, I don't think. I think they came on, but didn't really add too much. I think it kind of made them a little bit more disjointed when they came on. So... yeah, I think there are teething problems a little bit at the start of the season for Gamba, but I'm sure give it a couple of weeks, they'll get up to full gear.
Rightio then. All right, so we've got the 4 games left, listeners, and don't worry, we won't be stretching your ears for too much longer. The only game played on Sunday saw Fukuoka make their return to the top flight after a lengthy absence. They were undone by Mateus. Speaking of, at the start of the episode, Kawasaki picking up where they left off. Well, Mateus is in a similar boat. He got both of Nagoya's goals in their 2-1 win at the Level 5 Stadium. Got them off to a perfect start in just the 4th minute. Then 10 minutes into the second half made it 2-0 before a Yutaka Yoshida own goal set up a somewhat nervy finish for Grampus. But they were able to see things out. So, Dan, firstly, it's great to have Fukuoka back in to the top flight. The more Kyushu clubs, the better. I just hope one day I'll be able to get down there once all this has blown over in about 2024. But, quite a testing start back to life in J1 for them. The result didn't go for them, but I don't think they were disgraced on Sunday afternoon, were they?
No, not at all. They put Grampus to the test, it's tough to do that against a team with such a good defense, and I thought that the score line was fair to them, but I think that of the two promoted clubs, of course, now I know I'm going to put my foot into it because I can't remember... Of the two promoted clubs, I think I only picked one to get relegated in J-Pred, And now, for the life of me, I cannot remember which it was, so I am scrolling back, and it was... Okay, it was Fukuoka. So I take back everything I said. They've got no chance. you know, I mean, it's... You look at the, you know, when the promoted teams do well in the early games, you look at when the minnows do well, and, you know, everyone's rushing out to make conclusions. But, you know, if they can stay up, I'm absolutely happy to be proven wrong in my J-Pred, because I like having more teams out there in Fukuoka. I think it's good to have that rivalry culture emerge out there, not just be centered around the Tokyo area or the Kansai area. So, you know, best of luck to them.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, so Sam and Nagoya, obviously third place finishes last year. We're wondering how they'll get on this season after making such a huge climb up the table in 2020. And the ACL looms, I suppose. But until then, yeah, they've got games to play, and they've gotten off to an acceptable start. How did you think they went about it? Was there too much difference that you could tell from the 2020 version of Grampus to this first episode of the new series, if you like, or have they just carried on as they finished last year?
They carried on pretty much the same way. I think they've got an issue in terms of Yamasaki playing up front and Kakitani in behind. Neither of them offered anything in that game, so they were still quite heavily reliant on Mateus and Sommer, who I thought had a good game as well. I thought, yeah, the first goal is fantastic, the way that he just shimmies in and out the defenders, leaves them for dead, and tucks his finish home. And that's where they caused a lot of issues in Nagoya, where they brought Mateus over from the right-hand side and doubled up on Salomonsson with Sommer. I think Salomonsson is a very good player for Avispa. He's one of their best outlets, but he could be got at defensively, especially when he wasn't being given much support back there. And I just think Sommer had a fantastic game. He was going forward, he caused a few, he had a few chances, Murakami saved them. But also, Avispa's best line of attack is really through crosses into the box, especially when you've got Wanma and you've got Bruno Mendes. And so often last season it would come through Salomonsson, but in this game they put Sommer on him and he just tracked him every blade of grass through that pitch, and he got back, made so many blocks to stop the crosses, and I think that was really what helped Nagoya kind of nullify Avispa, because Avispa had occasional chances from set pieces, but really were limited to one header from Bruno Mendes, which, I mean, it would have taken something fantastic for him to have scored from that position. So Nagoya did really well at nullifying Avispa, and had a contender for goal of the season in Yoshida when he lobbed it over his own goalkeeper. So, yeah. But, yeah, I don't think Avispa would have necessarily scored without that. And that's not to say Avispa played poorly. I thought generally they defended well. They were physical. They were up for the battle. But really, Nagoya are just a very good defensive side, and Avispa won't come up against many sterner defences.
All right. So, yeah, sounds like the Grampus coaching staff deserve some praise for doing their homework on the impact that Emil Salomonsson can have on Fukuoka when they go forward. And yeah, as you say, getting Yuki Sommer to cover Salomonsson like a cheap suit appears to have helped to nullify him and helped Nagoya return home with all 3 points. All right, we have 3 games left to go, listeners, and they all ended in 1-1 draws. In the one that had most of Dan and my attention on Saturday afternoon, FC Tokyo headed up, made the short trip up to the Saitama Stadium to face Urawa. And, spoils were shared after a 1-1 draw. A couple of veterans on the score sheet. I would suggest that Urawa had by far the better of the run of play. Yuki Abe, I don't know whether he gave them a deserved lead because there was a little bit of fortune in his goal. But anyway, it was well taken with 16 minutes to go after goal. Hatano had made a good save. Abe bundled home from inside the box. But then with 4 minutes left, and much to my relief, and I'm sure Dan's as well, Masato Morishige rescued a point for FC Tokyo when he glanced in a header from the substitute Hirotaka Mita's free kick. Otherwise, Dan, yeah, I wasn't particularly enthused about the way Tokyo went about it. I know we do have a pretty dreadful record at Saitama Stadium, and to play there first and to come back with something, I suppose, is better than nothing, obviously. He says, yeah, extremely obviously, and especially when, yeah, you're 4 minutes away from losing the game, that would have been a bitter pill to swallow. But overall, yeah, I was slightly disappointed with the performance, again, taking into account it was the opening day of the season.
Yeah, Tokyo, are, you know, they've got players who aren't at 100%, like, you know, I think Diego and Nagai was
came off the bench. Yeah,
they're not quite there yet. They obviously had some pretty severe injuries at the end of last season, and that's not great. You know, Adailton comes off the bench at halftime, and he worked wonders. He's been sort of the secret weapon. It's been talked about a lot that he doesn't get as many starting roles as he perhaps should. But when him and Leandro are working together, and Diego as well, you know, that's a fairly unstoppable trio. Tokyo, I have them finishing outside the top four. I think that they're going to be, again, good enough to contend for a cup or two. I don't see this squad as being a title contender yet. Maybe they'll surprise us with a big signing in the next 3 to 4 weeks. But without that, you know, it's going to take time. And, you know, they've at least stabilized under Hasegawa. The shape, the formation looks good. Their attack is solid. The defense is mostly there. Hatano has settled into the role of starter, and I don't see Hayashi replacing him when he eventually gets healed up. And yeah, that's just the Tokyo that we're going to have to deal with this season.
Yeah, fair enough then. All right, Sam, might be a chance for you to build some bridges with your old sparring partner, Ryan Steele, here, because, yeah, I was quite impressed with Urawa. We'd spoken about the upheaval behind the scenes, perhaps late on in the preseason with Yosuke Kashiwagi and Kenyu Sugimoto hiring out a restaurant and having 3 glasses of beer, heaven forbid. Sugimoto had the dubious distinction of being the first player in J1 history to have a goal ruled out by VAR, or chalked off by VAR, in just the 5th minute. So that's something for your mantelpiece, Kenny. But yeah, otherwise, I was impressed with the way that Reds went about things. You've watched a lot more of Ricardo Rodriguez managed games than I have, so you can let me know or not whether you thought that Rodriguez's stamp was straight on Reds, but I was impressed by the way they hunted in packs and won the ball, tried to win the ball back as soon as they'd lost it. Tokyo never really were able to really get their counter-attacking game going because Reds were looking to smother them as soon as they'd lost possession themselves. So and it was a really interesting blend of a team that Rodriguez put out in his first game. I mean, the experience of Ugajin, Makino, and obviously Yuki Abe in the centre of midfield, and mixed in with youngsters like Atsuki Ito, Takahiro Akimoto, and most notably, I suppose, the signing from Ryukyu, Yoshio Koizumi, who I actually hadn't realised until watching the game on DAZN and the commentators mentioned it, is actually an ex-FC Tokyo under-15s player. So a little bit bittersweet for Gasmen supporters who follow the team all the way down to the lower age levels, because, I mean, they might have had their eyes on Koizumi for several years now, and then here he is stumping up in a Reds kit.
Yeah, I thought, I'd say the word I'd use to describe Reds was kind of fresh and a bit more refreshing than the way that they have been playing under Watsky. You were right in saying that the kind of the pressing from the Koizumi with Akimoto, the younger players with a lot of energy, they kind of harried Tokyo, caused errors, got the ball back. And there were moments, it wasn't throughout the entire 90 minutes, but there were passages of play where Reds were really getting their passing game going. Koizumi, I thought, was fantastic. His pass through for Sugimoto for his non-goal was sublime. harsh on Sugimoto. We've seen it in the Premier League for so long with these toes offside that cause the goals to be disallowed. I'm not particularly a fan of it, but that's the way it is, and it's unfortunate for Sugimoto. But yeah, generally speaking, I thought they were quite vibrant. Their passing at times was very good, and you can really see what Ricardo Rodriguez is trying to bring to the team. For so long under Otsky, no one had a clue where they were going. It was kind of rudderless. There was no real plan. But yeah, the young players came in. They were maybe a surprise to many people. Like Atsuki Ito coming into central midfield alongside Yuka Abe, it would have been a surprise given he's not really played for the last year or so. But it worked. And even they didn't have many options at the back. They kind of had to play at that back four because everyone else was injured or the really young player. But yeah, it worked okay. I think it will only get better. And I think these were fairly good signs, because Tokyo, I thought, was second best in this game. And a lot of that was down to the way that Urara pressed them. And yeah, hopefully that's a good enough olive branch for Ryan Steele. If not, we're going to have to thrash it out over a beer at some point.
Yeah, most definitely. No. Yeah, they definitely deserve the praise that's coming their way. And as we say, they were 4 minutes away from an opening day victory before the experienced Morishige rescued a point for Tokyo. In completely different circumstances, Sendai rescued a point of their own down in Hiroshima on Saturday afternoon in a similar time of the game as Kashiwa lost Takumi Kamijima to a straight red card at Cerezo Osaka. Simao Mate was shown a straight red for hacking down Junior Santos. That was in the 26th minute. And then 7 minutes later, Santos made the 10 men of Sendai pay when his blast took a deflection and flew past Jakub Slovic. But from there was no beating Slovic. And Dan, this is just an absolute triumph for Sendai's Polish goalkeeper. Some of the saves he pulled off in the second half were absolutely astonishing. And then the fact that the 10 men of Sendai were able to keep going and nick a point in the 90th minute, well, I don't know, if I was the Sendai players, I would have just been cheering Slovic off the field, because he kept them in the game, and somehow, some way, they rescued a point at the death.
It was truly an inspired performance among a team that was not very inspiring. It's fascinating to see a Polish goalkeeper getting it done in the J-League. I think we've touched on this before, but just it really does show you that, you know, how hard it is. That's the hardest position to be in as a foreign player, and it's a testament to his abilities that he's managed to work so well with his defenders and, you know, make good saves on top of that. There's only a handful of foreign goalkeepers who have really reached that level. I mean, especially goalkeepers from Europe and you know, Australia, from Western, you know, countries, where, you know, they might not have the Japanese skills. Mitch Langerak, if you're listening to this, shout out to you as well. And you know, he was definitely man of the match, and he carried them on his back for 90 minutes, and it was impressive.
Yeah, Sam. So the second half chances, I mean, there was a double save just before the hour from Yuki Nogami's header, and then Hayato Araki tried to bundle in from point-blank range. Somehow he kept that out. I don't know if we had goal-line technology. They might have been looking at that very closely. I'm not sure if the referee's watch would have been buzzing or not. But then with 5 minutes left, just flinging himself to his right to keep out Shunki Higashi's point-blank header. I mean, it was just remarkable, wasn't it? And then, yeah, I don't know, if he had any energy left, I would have been running the length of the pitch to go and hug Akasaki when he scored in somewhat fortunate circumstances. I mentioned that Santos's shot deflected on its way past Slovic. Well, Kunimitsu Sekiguchi, Ballon d'Or favourite, his shot deflected off a Hiroshima defender and allowed Akasaki the space to slot home. So, yeah, finally, after battening down the hatches for so long, it all paid off for Sendai, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. They kind of earned their own look, and, well, Slovak earned their look. I mean, that save from Higashi is so good. The reflexes, the kind of anticipation, the strength of his hand, but it's almost across the line when he saves it. It's a terrific save, and they've earned their draw, I think. I mean, you can say defensively, they were okay. I mean, Sanfrecce's chances, as you read out there, all from set pieces, all from defenders. So it wasn't like Junior Santos was having the runaround of the defence. I don't think he played particularly well. His goal was fortuitous in the way it deflects in. And, yeah, Sendai kept going. You've got to give them credit because, yeah, they were so up against it. But it's a huge amount of luck that when it falls into Akasaki and he gets the finish. But I've got to give them a lot of credit for just battling on. And I think Slovic is drew various beverages from his teammates for his performance. It was one of the most stunning goalkeeping performances I've seen in the J-League.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. All right, well, the final game we'll review, the last 1-1 draw of the match day came down in Oita, where host Trinita entertained promoted Tokushima Vortis. Oita had the ball in the net in just the fourth minute when Arata Watanabe scored from distance, but he had pushed the Vortis keeper, Naoto Kami Fukimoto, in the back to win the ball, so the goal was correctly ruled out. But then an Oita mishap from their keeper, Shun Takagi, presented Takeru Kishimoto with the opening goal. Ball was played over the top. Takagi came out and collided with a defender, allowing Kishimoto to sweep in to an unguarded net on his J1 debut. Then more Takagi calamity in the 42nd minute. It was almost 2-0. He came out for a high ball to the edge of the box, but missed his punch, and a Taisei Miyashiro's glancing header bounced inches wide. Then Kami Fukimoto was called into action to make a fine stop, parrying away Yuya Takazawa's fierce drive early in the second half. But, yeah, unfortunately for Kami Fukimoto, he probably should have done better on Oita's leveller just before the hour. Watanabe, who was busy on his top flight debut after coming in from Niigata, he drew the host level with a strike that Kami Fukimoto basically ended up palming into the roof of the net. Sam, you'll have been glad to see Shun Nagasawa come on for the final action of this game, the final 5 seconds. Of course, he didn't get a touch as the ball was punted upfield by the goalkeeper, and then the referee blew up. So a token appearance for Nagasawa on his debut for Oita. But yeah, that was it. And 1-1. I think Tokushima, although they've lost the lead, they'll be happy enough with a point away from home on the opening day.
I think so. It was kind of the cliched game of two halves where Vortis were the better team first half. They played a lot of good football. They were helped out by, I don't know what Takagi was on in that first half. He was just wound up and just ready to go, just rushing at the ball whenever he saw it. And yeah, caused one calamity, should have been two. He got very fortunate with that header that just went wide. And kind of Kami Fukimoto had a poor game at the other end. He got quite lucky with the Watanabe goal that was ruled out. I think it is correct, but what he's doing 30 yards from goal, I don't really know. And and then he should have done a lot better with the goal. So generally speaking, I think both teams will be quite happy with this. In possession, both teams look quite good. They play very nice football, but there are issues, I think, in both defences that are going to be brought to bear in various other games. But yeah, I think it was a decent game, and full credit to Oita for not starting Shun Nagasawa. They're trying to get back into my good books after they went down in my J-Pred purely for one transfer.
Okay. Well, yeah, Dan, I guess, yeah, Trinita down the table was a kind of a trendy pick in a few J-Preds here and there that I saw. And obviously Tokushima coming up as a promoted team. You know, oftentimes we don't have too much optimism when it comes to them. So, I don't know. We might not get too much of an opportunity to talk about them with you in the next month or so. So what are your expectations for these two in particular? Obviously, Trinidad coming off an eighth place finish or ninth place finish a couple of years ago, slipping down the table, and we're wondering if they're going in the wrong direction. Whereas Vortis, obviously their track record in J1 is absolutely horrendous, the worst season ever in J1, but this is a different incarnation. So where do you sit on both of these two teams? And again, after their 1-1 draw to open up the season?
I see Oita finishing probably lower mid-table, and I think Vortis, I think that they can maybe get some magic. I mean, I say get some magic going. First, they've got to get their manager into the country, which is probably a bigger concern. But I think that J-League magic will favor them. J-League chaos energy will favor our friends down in Shikoku, and I don't think that they're going to breach the top half of the table, but I can see them getting to like 14th, 13th, you know, just avoiding relegation. Yeah, if they can do that, it'll be a successful season.
Do you have any idea if Poyatos can have any influence on the game? Has he got, do you know if he's got a setup to watch in Spain at 5 in the morning or whatever it
no,
might be?
No, they're leaving it to Komoto on the ground. They're the head coach, and that's it. He is watching the video. He is giving feedback. He is having Zoom meetings with the players, with the coaching staff, with everyone involved. But until the current travel ban is rescinded, and the question as to when that will happen is shrug emoji. Yeah, like folks, we're waiting. That there, him and two dozen other players and another two dozen family members are waiting to get into Japan, and they may not be able to do so this month, for all we know. So that's the new normal for the J League.
Mm, rightio then. Okay, well, yeah, that's all of the 10 games. I'm used to saying 9, of course. 10 games from match day 1 covered, listeners. So thanks for sticking with us through all of that. Yeah, after some midweek Levain Cup exertions, match day 2 will take place almost exclusively on Saturday, 9 games taking place, with just the one, Yokohama F. Marinos hosting Hiroshima, to be played on Sunday. And Dan, just before we wrap up, and I know, yeah, you've got an event that you'd like to plug, and we're more than happy for you to do that. Just about the crowd numbers from the weekend and how that relates to prefectures in the state of emergency, etc., as it relates to the coronavirus. You very kindly walked me through a number of the regulations last week, but then I was afraid I would completely cock it up as I was trying to relay them to the listeners. So I ultimately didn't bother. So from the 10 games played over the weekend, I count 6 that were played in front of crowds less than 5,000. The biggest attendance of the weekend was just under 12,000 at the Sapporo Dome. So, what's the state of play with the state of emergency in different parts of the country, and who and what are allowed into your football stadiums at the moment?
Well, the current state of emergency covers 4 prefectures. That is Tokyo and then the surrounding prefectures, Kanagawa, Chiba, and Saitama. It started at 11, it got reduced to 10. Over the weekend, they decided to rescind the state of emergency in the Kansai area and basically everywhere outside of Tokyo. So the current government rules, the current J-League rules are that for prefectures inside the state of emergency zone or who are covered by the declaration, the limit is 5,000 fans. If they are not covered by the state of emergency, or I should say, if they were but are no longer covered by the state of emergency, the current government regulations are up to 10,000 through early April. I believe April 11th or 12th is the limit for that. The J-League has its own sort of step-up plan to allow teams with bigger stadiums to return to 50% capacity after they have gone through the state of emergency. So basically, they are allowed to have a game with 30% capacity and then go back to 50. If a team that is covered by the state of emergency plays a team that is not covered, then the home team is not allowed to set up a section for visiting supporters. So they're just discouraging travel from state of emergency areas. And If they aren't in the state of emergency and weren't covered, then just like last season, they're allowed to have up to 50% capacity and have away fans. Minimum is 3% of stadium capacity. I think it's stadium and not adjusted capacity. So that's basically where we're at. And the state of emergency also restricts the sale of food and drink. I believe the limit is 7 o'clock for last orders for booze. And games have to end by 8 o'clock. So we've had a handful of 7 p.m. kickoffs get shifted up to 6 p.m. To accommodate that. So I think that's everything.
All right, thank you very much for that. Explained in, much more succinct way than I would have been able to last week. So, I'm sure the listeners appreciate waiting a week to get that information. All right, and, you mentioned that to me that you were, part of a really interesting event related to women's football involving cross-cultural exchange, America and Japan. So, what can you tell us about that?
I have been asked to moderate part of an event that's happening later this month, March 19th in the U.S., the morning of Saturday, March 20th in Japan. So the event is called We Have the Spirit. It's about the relationship between the U.S. and Japan and just talking about how women's football is strengthening that. And the developments that are happening with the Wii League coming in and with a lot of Japanese players going to the NWSL. So it's going to be Kikuko Okajima, who's the chair of the Wii League, as well as Kumi Yokoyama and Saori Takarada, who are playing for the Washington Spirit. So it's sponsored by the Japanese embassy in the U.S. It might feature a couple other guests. I'm going to be moderating the Q&A as far as I know, and it should be cool. It's free. You can go sign up. It is wehavethespirit.com, and there's going to be simultaneous interpretations, so if you're listening to it in Japanese or in English, you'll be covered, and it'll be cool. So it's my first time doing this sort of big event moderation, and I'm just hoping that I don't screw up in front of a big audience. But for that to happen, first there has to be a big audience, so I hope that listeners will check that out.
Yeah, terrific. Sounds really interesting, Dan. So all the best, and break a leg and all that. Yeah, I'm sure you'd do a terrific job. Sounds fantastic. All right, well, with that, I think we will leave it there. Sam, it's I think it's quite miraculous, to be perfectly honest, that we've managed to come in well under 2 hours in our Match Day 1 review podcast, especially with all the VAR chat we had to we have to do because it's part of the game now. But confusion reigned at times. But ultimately we got there, and so off and running, and looking forward to what the league serves up next weekend.
Yeah, I'm very surprised. I thought we could have done 2 hours on the Cerezo Kashua game on its own, but we've done surprisingly well, strangely for us. And I'm glad this season's underway. We've had some good action. Hopefully that continues. We've got midweek games for the ACL clubs coming, and then a full weekend next weekend. So let it roll on.
Most definitely. And Dan, obviously busy getting to games when you can for the Japan Times, and your regular column continuing throughout the season. So we're looking forward to reading you on a regular basis in the paper, and hopefully catching you again on the podcast pretty soon as well.
Absolutely. Going to be a long one, but it is nice to be able to write about football when a year ago we were writing about the fact that there was no football. So that is progress, I suppose.
Very well said, very well said. All right, well, that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to very much thank Dan Olowitz for his time on this week's episode. We'd like to thank Khalil, Alan, James, Johnny, Steve F, and Charlotte for their questions. And, of course, listeners, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week with a full review of J1 Match Day 2. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yosh, 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 yosh.